Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What would you do if you had the security clearance to look at classified military documents? It's a tantalizing question, the stuff of spy thrillers. Having access would mean that you're in on some of the most consequential secrets on the planet, right? But these days, there are fewer and fewer secrets. Thanks to the internet, there's so much more opportunity for secrets to become not so secret. You don't need a security clearance anymore. You just need a computer connected to the internet. There's a newish field of research called Open Source Intelligence Gathering, or OSINT. OSINT researchers use publicly available information to keep tabs on the world's most pressing issues: wars, crises, civic unrest, neo-fascism, corruption. It's often in these moments when the story is murkiest. Maybe you've heard the phrase, the fog of war. In a nutshell, OSINT researchers scrounge the internet looking for anything that can help clear that fog away. Joining me now is Arik Toller, the head of training and research at Bellingcat, an international collective of OSINT investigators that uses social media and public sources to document conflict, crime, and human rights abuses around the world. Arik, welcome to All of It.
Thanks for having me.
I want to go through some examples of what open source investigations look like, just to help people, those of us who don't completely understand what we're talking about. So right now, the featured story on Bellingcat involves trying to find the location of a person of interest in a child abuse case. And the researchers used something called geolocation to figure out that he had been at a resort in Turkey. Arik, just start there. What is geolocation, and how big of a role does it play in the kind of work that you guys do?
Sure. So geolocation is a really fancy way of saying figuring out where a photo or video was taken, which sometimes is extremely simple, right? If I just take a photo from outside my house right now, I'm in Kansas City, you know, you would see some maybe street signs, street lights, houses, trees, streets. You know, it's pretty easy. If you live in the area, you know where it is. And if not, you can go to Google Street View, cruise around, you can find it eventually. But it can get complicated, right? If you're working with something like, for example, we do a lot of work on the war in Yemen. So if there's a wedding or a church or something that has an airstrike, the features that are visible are a little bit harder than, you know, a church, you know, right outside my window, a little bit easier to find than a destroyed mosque in Yemen. So it's a kind of a more of a creative art, I guess you could say, than a simple technique sometimes, because you have to be very creative in how you do this work. So the case you're talking about in particular with the child abuse image, this is an image that was shared by the FBI related to a child abuse case. And they shared a handful of photos and videos, or not videos, just a few photos of, with things blurred, of course, showing the background of a resort in a street. And if you just look at this with, you know, untrained or untrained eye, there's nothing there. There's a pool. There's a few. There's a trash bin. There's a lawn chair. There's really nothing you can see. And even if you had been to this resort, you may not even recognize it. It's so vague. It looks like it could be any hotel pool of anywhere. But Carlos, an investigator in our team, he studied this for hundreds of hours. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. And he found out the exact lawn chair that was used, the exact trash bin, the exact arrangement of bricks on the road. The reflections in the window, they can just barely make out a Turkish flag. They found out where these bins distributed, where these lawn chairs used, and they looked at dozens and hundreds of resorts all throughout Turkey before he found the right one. So this is kind of a combination of some creative ingenuity, kind of what you imagine like on the CSI, these magic computer programs. But, you know, behind this magic is actually just hundreds of hours of labor and frustration and trial and error.
You said he looked at hundreds of resorts, so he compared like snippets of this picture that he had to other pictures of other resorts that people had posted online.
Exactly. So you go through TripAdvisor, Yelp, Foursquare, reviews on Google, things like that, just because tourists take photos, right? Obviously, if you're at a resort, you're at a hotel, take a photo, because you're a tourist. And because of the giant wealth of photos and videos and user reviews and things like that, there's tons and tons of source material. So when we do this work, it's kind of, you're looking for, needle in a haystack. Maybe needle in a haystack is too generous. Maybe like a needle in a forest, laying up somewhere in the forest bed. Knowing exactly where to look is difficult. But it's just a massive amount of trial and error. and just kind of training your eye and knowing what to look at, try to very quickly process through these possibilities before you find the right one. And it's not just the issue of time, of place, but also time, because this photo is Carlos determined by looking at the chronological features, right? So there are renovations and changes and new lawn chairs are bought and so on. He did not just establish where it was, exactly which resort on coastal Turkey this was taken, but also when. I think it was something like March or May 2006.
Incredible.
This was, 15 years ago. And so a lot of times you're looking at photos that are 15 years old on TripAdvisor and these various review sites.
Wow. Some other work that you guys have done with online photos. In 2016, you wrote a guide to help identify corrupt officials using Instagram. Can you give us an overview of what that project looked like?
Yeah, so we do. Instagram is kind of an easy example of this, but there's lots of other ones as well. So I'm not sure exactly which case we discussed in that guide, but it was a handful of years ago. But one I can think about in particular was this Ukrainian official in particular. So it was this official in Ukraine who was ostensibly in charge of fighting corruption, and usually the people who are in charge of fighting corruption are the ones who are most corrupt. And I had a friend who was a Ukrainian journalist who was looking into this guy. And one of the tips that we had from this guy was that he had a birthday party for his son, his 13-year-old son. And kind of at the climax of his party, he gifted his 13-year-old son a Ferrari. And this was a mini scandal in Kiev and Ukraine when this happened, because here's a corruption, anti-corruption official giving his, who ostensibly, officially, according to public declarations, made $25,000, $30,000 a year, and he gave his son a Ferrari that's, triple his yearly salary. And some of the ways we did investigations into him, looking at his wife in particular, who was posting photos on her social media, her Instagram, on her other social network sites, of all the fancy things they were doing. They had vacations at the Maldives. She had fancy watches that cost thousands of dollars, pictures of their various houses, and so on. So this kind of, it's not just in Ukraine, this is all over the world. People who do a lot of anti-corruption research in particular look at the social media accounts of not just corrupt officials, but their family members, because often, the rich kids of Instagram, I guess you could say, who their kids maybe post pictures from their vacations they take or of cars that they have that go well beyond their the means of their public declarations, their public salary.
Yeah, amazing. If you're just joining us, Arik Toler, the head of training and research at Bellingcat, an international collective of OSINT, open source intelligence gathering investigators, is joining us now on All of It. I'm Matt Katz. I'm filling in for Allison Stewart. And Arik, I want to talk about the ethically gray area in some of this work. Recently, a group of Bellingcat researchers looking into QAnon found a trove of emails that shouldn't have been public, but they were able to get their hands on them because of a vulnerability with the email service. Exploiting software vulnerabilities is what hackers do. So how does Bellingcat draw the line between what's publicly available and then what's not really publicly available?
Yeah, it's a tough question. It's kind of a lot of these areas and questions are they're both very old and also very new, because these questions of what you should and can and should do ethically is a tough thing to wrestle with. The thing you're talking about, particularly these emails, it wasn't actually the emails that were leaked. What was happening was this is the Watkins son and father and son. If anyone's seen the recent HBO documentary on QAnon, you know all about the Watkins. But they're the people who are running the site 8kun, or formerly 8chan, which is this crazy extremist site that QAnon originated on. Well, it migrated to eventually. And what happened was the mail server for their personal mail server they use for their business, the server logs and traffic logs were openly available. Just type in the URL, it's right there. You don't have to put in any username or password. It's openly available, but they just left it open on accident. They left the door open, as you could say. And you can't actually see the content of their messages. All you can see is message received, message sent, and that's it. You can't see the content. But within this, these traffic logs, there's a lot of interesting stuff, because you can see that the Watkins, I think it was the father, not the son, who did his email, he was messaging all sorts of QAnon influencers. So there's like coordination going on. You can cross-match when these emails are happening. You can't see the content, but you see when, when they were post-dated, more or less. And you can see spikes of different activities that are being done all over the internet that corresponds with these emails. But this is a question that goes beyond just this, because when we do this work with social media and openly available information, just because something is openly available doesn't mean it should be further shared or highlighted. So just the question, give some example of this that's very relevant, is if you remember the downing of the Ukrainian airliner over Iran from a little over a year ago. So This is right pre-pandemic. It feels like 10 years ago, but it was actually just right before the pandemic. The Ukrainian airline was shot down over, killed almost 200 people over Tehran. And for quite a while, there's only one video showing the downing. There's some guy or girl was standing outside of a construction site in a suburb of Tehran, held his phone up or her phone up and saw that a missile came up and hit the plane, killed almost 200 people. And for quite a while, for a few days, this is the only video showing the downing. Now, luckily, this person filmed it from the street. They weren't in their apartment balcony. They weren't doing it from the balcony of their apartment. But just imagine that this maybe what this was the only video that would then bring Iran to admit culpability, which they did admit culpability in the shootdown. Imagine if this person filmed it from their apartment balcony. Well, on one hand, you know, you have justice for almost 200 people who died, you know, accountability, all those things. But this person maybe disappeared the next day because he could figure out exactly where their apartment is based off of the location of the video. So thankfully, this person filmed it from the street, so we don't have that issue. But that's one of the questions we wrestle with is, you know, even though something may be on Facebook or Twitter and Instagram, it may be meant for their 20 followers, not 200,000 people watching, you know, CNN or whatever. So there's a lot of ethical questions that come up with this, and there are, a lot of times are new questions or just repackaging of very old questions in different ways.
Yeah, for sure. But with this technology, you end up having lay people are just taking photos and videos who then are involved in, you know, geopolitical security crises and potentially putting themselves in danger. It's a fascinating new world. I'm curious, now that governments and militaries know that there's this higher level of scrutiny on them, given this technology, have they changed the way they operate or changed the way they share certain information with the public?
They try. So the big thing we always go back to is Russia. I studied in graduate school. I studied Russian literature, so this is my kind of area of expertise. So I just want to know that. I'm sure it's much different for other areas and other countries. I don't know quite as much about, but I know about Russia. I talk about Russia. So in Russia, in particular, this has been an issue that the government has been grappling with. So back in 2014, when the war in eastern Ukraine broke out after the annexation of Crimea. Russia was involved in the war in eastern Ukraine, but they, of course, didn't want war to get out about their soldiers going, you know, taking quote-unquote vacations to eastern Ukraine and then coming back with tanks and guns and all sorts of other fun stuff. And something they were wrestling with is, you know, these Russian soldiers, usually they're, you know, guys, 20, 21, 22-year-old guys who maybe leaving the country for the first time. They're from some village. They're, you know, having a good time going off on quote-unquote vacation to eastern Ukraine, and they bring their cell phones with them. And, well, you know, this isn't exactly going to Syria or Libya. Their cell phones work because, it's, you know, and it's like me going to Canada. The cell phone service in Ukraine works for Russian phones, same way as me going to Canada or Mexico. My phone would still work. Mm-hmm. So there was an issue they had with Russian soldiers who were taking photos and selfies and stuff from the border, you know, the border area between Russia and Ukraine. But even some of them were posting photos from within Ukraine of themselves fighting, posing next to street signs, posing next to, you know, tanks and destroyed buildings and all that stuff because they were like, you know, they were soldiers, but they were also kind of tourists in a way, too. And they tried to crack down through some ways. They passed the quote-unquote anti-selfie soldier laws, you know, the anti-social media sharing laws. But this is only goes so far because you can only, like, you can't legislate your way out of every problem. Because, again, at the base of this, again, you have, you know, 20-year-old kids who were leaving home for the leaving the country for the first time who want to share information online. And, you know, no matter what you do, you can't get... You know, you can't get through the head of a 20-year-old, you know, with all the legislation in the world. This isn't just the Russia thing. Turkey is having this problem as well, too, because especially countries that have conscription, you know, people sneak in phones. People sneak them in. They post. They want to talk to their girlfriend back home or their mom or sister or whatever. So they send stuff back, and sometimes the information gets leaked out. So countries have tried to legislate their way out of some of these issues, especially around information security with active-duty military soldiers. But it, again, you can't, the willpower of a 20-year-old who wants to send a photo back to their girlfriend is stronger than any law you can pass.
Totally. And then the girlfriend may be posting it, and then there you go.
Exactly, yeah.
How does Russia feel about the work that you're doing, and you personally?
Well, yeah, they aren't very big fans. So a lot of the work we do focuses on Russia, not because we necessarily have some like hatred towards Russia. I've lived in Russia. I like the country quite a bit in different ways. I studied Russian literature from grad school, but the reason why Russia is so such a fertile ground for this research is because it has a kind of a unique profile with this. You simultaneously have extreme Russian or extreme digital literacy. People know how to use the internet, and they are all on social media, and they have good cell phone coverage and 3G and all that stuff. And the government also is all doing a lot of things. You know, the U.S. does a lot of nasty things too, but we just aren't quite so flagrant and open and clumsy about it as the Russian security services and military are often. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we do a lot of work on different Russian activities. We do stuff on Russian spy operations, on Russian military operations and things like that. And with the spy operations in particular, it's that's the thing that probably annoys them the most about the work we do. We can find the work of Russian FSB, which is like internal security, kind of like our FBI, and GRU, which is military intelligence, something kind of like the CIA is what we have. Their activities both at home and abroad, where they, you know, assassinate people, they blow things up, and they hack various international bodies. And luckily for us, not so luckily for them, their people sometimes are really effective, but they're very clumsy about what they do. Their cover identities are very easy to find. Russian data security is virtually non-existent. You can purchase people's travel and phone records for, you know, maybe, you know, a fraction of a Bitcoin, you know, maybe $50-$60. You can buy someone's phone records, add it to your cart like an Amazon website. Again, data privacy is virtually non-existent throughout Russia. And because of that kind of very loose data restrictions and a lot of petty corruption, especially in the police and government ranks, people leak information. Not because they're noble whistleblowers, but because, you know, this is regularly done, the data black market, people trying to make an extra buck too. And the laws are so loosey-goosey that people can get away with it. You can just bribe someone, you can get punishment with this kind of thing. So yeah, because of that, yeah. It's a very fertile ground for doing investigations into wrongdoing, both in the country and abroad.
Fascinating. You know, some of your investigations happen collaboratively in public on Twitter. Are there certain accounts people should follow, certain hashtags, certain sites that we should check out to people want to search themselves or at least, you know, see how this process works?
Yeah, there's a lot of people do this online. This is kind of a hobby people have. A lot of people who work with us who are getting paid to do this for a living. Most people who get paid for doing this did it for fun for quite a while. Some people garden, some people ride their bikes, some people, you know, stalk people on Instagram, I guess you could say. But for good, not for bad, right? Completely. So obviously, the Bellingcat, we have our stuff online, and there's all sorts of different. If you type in OSINT, OSINT in the Twitter, you'll find dozens and hundreds of accounts who do this work. But really, think about different areas you're interested in. I mean, obviously, in the U.S. there's lots of stuff that's interesting. A lot of people who do a lot of OSINT work around government corruption, around the January 6th insurrection. There's a whole cottage industry of people who are still doing research about the photos and videos that came out of the Capitol, and into the Capitol. And all sorts of other stuff. It's not just, you know, geopolitically explosive events and conflicts and spy work. A lot of people do work on environmental issues. You can observe satellite imagery and changes in landscapes and deforestation and air pollution with oil wells burning in Iraq and Syria and things like that. So there's all sorts of really interesting areas for this OSINT work. It's not all just bombs and guns and spies. A lot of people do really fascinating work on environmental issues, and also things are a little bit maybe more fun too. I mean, maybe more fun, I guess maybe that word's doing a lot of work. My colleague Fuka, for example, in the Netherlands, he did a really fascinating investigation looking at Instagram influencers who take photos with illegally trafficked wildlife, so tigers, lions, tigers, and bears, right? Mostly in Dubai and some the Gulf states, and kind of tracking about these, you know, these Instagram followers of 2 million Instagram influencers with, you know, 2 million followers, they take a photo of themselves with a tiger cub. So what he was doing is, like, where these tiger cubs come from, who's running this? This is illegally trafficked wildlife. These are endangered species. How does this happen? So he was kind of digging through and stalking all these Instagram celebrities. And I'm looking at the details of the apartments where they took the photos, because they bring them to the apartment of the guy doing the trafficking.
Amazing.
Often. And then look into it. So it's not all just moms and guns and spies. It can be things that are a little bit more accessible to.
Fascinating. I feel like we're still in the early stages of this technology and where it can take us. Arik Toler is the head of training and research efforts at Bellingcat, an international collective of OSINT investigators that uses social media and public sources to document conflict, crime, and human rights abuses around the world. Arik, this was so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us on all of it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.